Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Christine Williams.
And you are listening to Fiber Talk, that twice weekly podcast for people who make fine art with needle and thread. I'm sticking with that for a while, I think. I think it's, it kind of captures.
I like it.
Yeah. It captures. And speaking of fine art, our guest this week, Jill Vendatulli. Did I say that right, Jill?
You got it, Gary.
Jill, I've only seen a couple people that operate like you do with the needlepoint approach. Really gorgeous stuff. I have no idea how you do it. do we call this?
Very different.
Yeah. Do we call this freeform needlepoint? Can we do that? How do you view what you do?
I don't know that I would. I'm an unorthodox stitcher, but most of it is pretty accessible. I've done a few pieces that would be, you know, freeform, but most of them are done with continental stitch, long and short, sometimes other stitches. It's sort of my approach to subject matter, my fibers. My palette really is probably often what sets me apart from other people, and my subject matter too, which I've started to do a lot more abstract work.
Yeah, that's the more recent stuff is the abstract work?
Yes, that's right. Oh. Yeah. I've been stitching for 30 years. In the beginning, I did adaptations of artwork, and I did that for a number of years. And then probably within the last, 15 years, I started to do, you know, truly original works of art that are completely my own, out of my head. Based on often doodles that are extremely small that become very large tapestries.
Yeah, that's the other. See, yes, I figured you were one of those people that it's just in your head and it just falls out.
Yeah. It's a scary place, Gary, but yes.
Yeah, I could sense that. Yeah, just it's in my head. We've talked to others who are like that, yes.
Yeah, it seems like There's two kinds of people. There's the, I have no idea how anybody does that, and I'm afraid. And then there's the, my head is brimming with things, and I can't stop drawing them. And I haven't yet figured out what's the trigger to switch from one to the other.
I think it's temperament. I'm the person whose brain never shuts off. Most of the time, I have trouble sleeping, and so during that time, some of my best ideas are 2 o'clock in the morning where I'm sitting in a dark room with no distractions, and I can envision what it is I want to do next.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are ridiculous to think of these things in the middle of the night and wake up in the morning and then, you know, spout out my next plan, which will take 5 to 10 months to stitch.
An element of fearlessness as well, it sounds like.
Christine, it's the strangest thing. When I started stitching, I did a couple of kits. And by 1990, I had started to draw things out and transfer them onto canvas. And I, for the first, I don't know, 10, 15 years, it astounded me. Because when you put a needle in my hand, I had no fear. It was as if I had a guardian angel stitching with me. I had somebody over my shoulder telling me what to do next. I never had to think. It just happened. I knew where to put the needle. And it's been that way ever since. And it's not something I take for granted. I'm extremely grateful for it.
So you did very little of what we would call more conventional stitching then.
The early days, as I said, were a couple of kits. But the stitches, the first piece I ever did, and this is what happens when people begin things. If they're extremely arrogant, which is what I was when I started, my first original piece was 36 by 28 inches.
Holy smokes.
And, it took 8 months and I had just done the traditional continental stitch, for the kits. And then when I found that there were all these stitches out there after I bought a book, I was like, oh, I have to include all of these. And I would go into the needlepoint shop and I would tell them my next plan. And they'd say, well, I'm not really sure you can do that. And I'd just look at them and go home and do it. And it's pretty much been that way.
Don't tell me I can't do that.
it is one of those things where I consider my needlepoint, it's my art, it's my voice, and I will express it the way I want to, the way I'm comfortable, the way it speaks to me, that I have to express it that way. So I don't tend to. I was probably, you know, despite the fact I got A's in school, I'm not a good student. I just like to sort of pursue things from my own perspective. And needlepoint has been one of these things where I've been so able to explore what you could do with it. I hope that slowly I'm imparting that to others, because I think I just finished a workshop retreat down at Winterthur Museum, and several women came up to me during the off times and said how much they wish they had taken the class, but then they said, but I'm not ready. And I thought, you got to take that step at some point. It is, you know, putting yourself out on that limb, but trying something new can be so liberating. And I'm a believer that we all possess some gift, no matter how, you know, naive it can be in representation. We all can create.
Say, I don't know what makes you ready. You know, I don't think anyone ever feels ready for anything big. You know,
I think it's a confidence level that, because if you've never done anything creatively, I think you're waiting for that moment of inspiration. And I'm not sure that people will find it the way they think they're going to. It's really just about saying, I want to try something new. Mm-hmm. And the whole premise behind me taking up needlepoint was because I wanted to try something new. And it was completely different than what I was doing in the rest of my life. So I encourage people. I use the cave painters as an example of artwork that people just, it came from within. It did not have training. And yet here we are thousands of years later, still trying to figure out what they were saying. And it's considered some of the earliest art in existence. So mm-hmm. I very much want people to feel that needlepoint as art is something that they should try, even if it's just once. And they come up with this one object. I have a student from last year, and he wanted to make plaid seat cushions. And I said, great. And we worked out a design. And he said, I want to practice on a small one, and then I'll work up to the seat cushions. Well, he finished his small plaid, and he said, I'm not stitching those seat cushions. I want to make something really big and colorful. And done it. And I was like, oh, my goodness, this worked. I said, you graduated fast. But it was that he had this whole sense of between looking at what I do and what it made him feel, that he wanted to try more.
Yes. That must be very gratifying.
It certainly is, yes. Can't please me any more than that, than somebody saying they want to try expressing themselves with needle and thread in a, you know, largely non-traditional way. My work is mostly non-traditional, but it all has meaning, and it's all about events and emotions, and it's, as I said earlier, it's my voice. Apparently, I have a very colorful one.
Yes, you do. That's kind of sad. That's a great story. And as a former teacher, I relate to that, because there is nothing like that, having the light go on for a student and they just take off with it. But mm-hmm. it also saddens me a bit in that the social stigmas, you know, I wonder how many males through the years could have experienced that if it hadn't been for, you know, the social, that's women's work type mm-hmm. cloud. Because, you know, I mean, there's an incredible number of artistic men, obviously, through history. And And I just wonder how many would have taken a needle and thread and done something amazing.
The irony there, Gary, is during the Renaissance, most of the needlework, embroideries and things were made by guilds, and they were all composed of men because women weren't allowed in the guilds. So men originally were making these elaborate bed covers and crewel work, and as time passed, it became women's work or women's leisure work, so to speak, because needlepoint certainly was always more of a leisure thing as opposed to a necessity. It wasn't like making the rag rugs they needed for the floors or bed linens and things like that. But it started men doing the elaborate crewel work. And maybe eventually, I mean, Rosie Grier did needlepoint, so.
Yeah, he comes up every time, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does, because you've got to have this ideal of this extremely butch guy with needlepoint to sort of drive the point home that, well, if he can do it, you know, I shouldn't be embarrassed to do it either. And there have been men who've done it, just like there have been men who knit. But as a general rule, I think fiber art, as a group, has far more female practitioners than male.
Oh, yeah. Now, see, I didn't know that about male guilds back long ago doing stitching. That's a new one for me.
Yeah, medieval guilds and, I think more medieval than actually Renaissance, but the medieval guilds were all male. Women weren't involved in them. And most of the tapestries that were made during the Renaissance were all designed by men and then sent to places where they were woven, but they were designed by men, male artists, that some of them quite famous for other things, but they also were responsible for producing some absolutely stunning woven objects.
Well, I'm going to have to do some research. I did not learn something, you know, every day.
That's a good thing.
But that always cracks me up about Rosie Grier, because often when I mention about doing needlework, to someone who doesn't know it, then someone will bring up, well, Rosie Grier did it. And then I always want to say, all right, name a second one. You know, name a second knowledgeable or, you know, a really high-level, visible person that goes with Rosie.
Well, obviously, Kate said the designer is, you know, on a level well beyond Rosie Grier. But he certainly has taken all of the fiber arts to new heights.
Yeah. Okay. We got two now. Writing that down.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's just one of those things that always kind of, because for years, you know, I just did it quietly and didn't make a big deal of it. And, you know, whenever, a few times I would take a class, I was always the only male. And in our A&G guild, I'm always the only male. And, you know, I just accept that. But, yeah, as I've gotten older, I've cared less. So mm-hmm. It's just.
Yeah. Well, there are, it's generally a thing of age.
Yeah. There's a number of men who comment on postings. And I know of a few in particular that are stitchers. But on the Facebook needlepoint pages, there are, some men that seem to be stitchers and a few that I do know. So I think there's maybe more out there than we realize, but it's still a minority compared to the women.
Yeah, and social media has made that possible. Mm-hmm. Has allowed them to express and get involved. That's been a real plus from it. Because there are more men, I think, than we realize, without a doubt. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So do you have an artistic background? Usually when we talk to people where these things fall out of their heads, it's because they have an art background. Do you have an art background?
I went back to school when I was 40 and took 13 classes in art history and studio art. And I have to say that they were very important in terms of freeing me up to try new things in ways that prior to that I wouldn't have done. I would not have conceived of hanging a tapestry from a piece of needlepoint from the ceiling. I would not have thought of making a sculptural piece of needlepoint. The 2 and 3D design classes, you know, even more than some, you know, like the drawing and the painting classes, which I had taken years ago. But these were sort of, they made you think outside the box. And the one thing that I wanted to do with my needlepoint was to go in that direction. And so they were very helpful. But as art background goes, no, as a stitcher, I'm self-taught. All that you see in my work, I certainly didn't encounter anything like that in any art class that I took in terms of the designs and the concepts. And that's all that's come in the last 15 years from just experimenting and trying and insomnia.
An important factor.
Sometimes it's a gift.
There are times, Christine, it's a gift when I, you know, I'm brimming with ideas at dawn. But then there are other times where it's like, okay, you don't need any new ideas right now. Go to sleep, which is helpful too. But I call them visions because it's usually, as I said, in a darkened room where I have just blank space, just sort of see ideas, and I can envision them fairly accurately and decide how I want to pursue them and with what fibers I want to use. And so, yeah, I can't, if I slept every night, my world might be a little less colorful. So I'm going to, I guess, hope that I lose a night now and then.
So what is your process? Take your abstract ones. You have a vision, you see colors, you see threads and shapes. Do you sit down and do a pencil drawing? How do you go about what you put together?
Usually, yes. It's not always the case that I need to, but very often I will do a sketch to scale of the size piece I'm going to be creating. And then I will transfer it onto canvas and at that point start putting together my fibers that I sort of, my palette that I've envisioned for the piece. And one of the neat things about living and stitching in the 21st century is there's so many fabulous fibers out there now that weren't available in the past. And I am an unorthodox stitcher. I will not just use needlepoint threads or what is used on normal needlepoint pieces. I stitch on almost always Penelope canvas. I just have always liked the idea that I can add detail or not. My canvas is there to use as I see fit. And so I can use a thicker fiber than if I were using a 14, 16, or an 18 count. And I've discovered all of these, just, I call them scrumptious. They're just so beautiful. They're like candy to me. I look at them and you know, my heart starts to beat faster. They're variegated threads that go in and out of wool to this effervescent coloring throughout the skein of yarn. And what I do is I pick and choose. I'll take this great big ball of yarn and then I will just cut the pieces where and how I want to use them. And it's just been, again, every time I take a leap and I go a little bit further away from that comfort zone where I say, ooh, people are not going to like this. It's da-da-da-da-da. And then it's like, yeah, but I've got to do it because of the effect is so powerful color-wise. It is, you know, I had a show here. I have a small gallery attached to the house, and I have a show here every 2 years or so when I have enough new work. And I had one last year, and I mean, the thing that people, when they walk in the door, is just blown away by color. And the art too, but it's the idea that there's most people don't use as much color as I use. I don't know why, because it's out there and it's stunning, but a lot of people have a much more tempered palette than I do.
Yeah, when I first looked at your website, the picture of you working there under the lamp, and just that apparent wad of thread over to the left, and I immediately had this vision of a painting artist with smudges of paint everywhere, and this mixed and that discarded, and just struck me as the same kind of thing, only with thread.
Yeah, when I'm stitching, I can't stitch fast enough. My hands just don't move as fast as my mind is looking to what I'm doing. There have been two instances in the last 30 years where I have stitched so fast that I've broken the needle. It's just snapped. It got so hot, it broke. But it's not that I'm in a race or that I'm under some sort of pressure other than self-imposed. That is about, I've got to get this piece done. It's about the fact that when I'm working, my brain is so fully engaged that it's almost impossible for me to stop. When I'm stitching, I stitch 6 to 8 hours a day. And I have a lovely Staples office chair with, you know, memory foam back and all lumbar support and all that stuff, because I'm in this chair for hours on end. And I have a custom-made frame that I had somebody make for me, gosh, 25 years ago. And God help me when something happens to that frame, because we're sort of besties at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a beast of a thing, but just about everything you do is of some size anyway, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I will do things that are smaller, but I still work on the frame because, A, I like the tension. I like the fact that my work has minimal distortion at the end. And when you're using varying fibers and thicknesses, you want to keep the canvas as taut as possible, because if it weren't that way, I would have a really, it would be a wavy piece of artwork at the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. You work on Penelope canvas. We don't see that very often. And it's, I only had one encounter. I was in Europe on a trip, probably 30 years ago. And there was a needlework store, and I bought a canvas. It was Penelope, and it was the standard needlepoint basket of flowers. And brought it home. And you know, years later, I realized why it was on Penelope, so you could do that detail if you wanted to. But but I just chickened out, and then one day I just threw it away because I knew I'd never do it. But you could see the flexibility it would give over conventional canvas.
And it's one of those things that it was the first canvas that when I started making my own that was available to me. And we all sort of stick with some things that we just think, oh, that's the material we work with. That's what we're comfortable with. And I have used other canvases. But in the end, I always go back to it. It's getting harder and harder to find. But I usually buy it in bulk so that I have several years ahead. But it just is, to me, it has, it's very pliable. At times I feel it's softer than some of the other canvases, but it's just, for me, I get to put in that detail if I want to. And yet, that tan hides a few of my mistakes.
Well, that was something, Orna Willis, we talked to her, and she uses as her standard, regular canvas, but as her standard, a tan brown color. And we asked her about that, and she said it's because it basically disappears visually unless the colors pop out, which is the last thing you would think. You'd think it would have to be white, but she's right. It really does.
No, the white actually any errors you make in white or the stitches, if there's a tension issue, the white, it's going to just be glaring. With the tan colored canvas, I recently discovered on a, let's see, the piece was made in 92. So that's, okay, that's 26 years ago. I just was looking at a piece that I did 26 years ago, and I'm like, oh my God, there's 6 stitches missing in a row here. Never saw it for 26 years. And I usually give my work a pretty good look over, but because of the tan canvas, it did not pop out at me. So maybe it's a bad thing. I don't know. But I'll stick with it as long as I can get it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was going to ask you about actually buying Penelope canvas, because that's very little demand for that anymore, I think.
Yeah. No, I mail ordered a company. I forget where they were, on the West Coast, and I'm due for an order. So I usually get 5 to 10 yards at a time.
Oh, my. Mm.
Well, and then you can cut it however you like too. That's the nice flexibility. Sometimes we're running into with other things where, you know, you can only get them in proscribed, you know, sizes that are the sizes you're supposed to use, you know. Yeah. And it's very limiting.
Extremely. I would not be happy with that. I haven't dealt with that in a very long time. So some of the pieces I do are quite large. And even my frame I had made to accommodate the average width of the largest width of any needlepoint canvas. So I was set for, a big piece, but, I would hate, being sort of limited to only making things a certain size. 'Cause then I'd have to sew them together in order to make a big one. And
mm-hmm.
I've never done that. I've never had to do that, and I don't think I want to start.
that is that frame a scroll frame or a slate frame? What is the design on that?
It's a scroll. The exposed area is would be 16 by 40 at any given time. So then I just keep going either direction, whichever direction I need to go. People would be stunned if they realized how often I'm stitching upside down. because of the way the design is, I will just move my chair and have to make the piece sort of looking up from the opposite direction of the way it's going to be viewed. But there aren't too many other frames that I've seen that could accommodate that, especially for big pieces like that. And it's got, good legs on the bottom and supports, and it's extremely sturdy. I worked with a furniture maker, and we came up with the design, and he did it in mahogany so that it would look nice in the room. And it's a pretty frame.
That's a piece of furniture.
As well as functional.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah, I can see why you get attached to that thing and without
well,
it.
Well, I just don't know if I could ever replace it, Gary. It's that nice piece.
Yeah. So now your pieces, you say you have a show every now and then. Is the primary purpose to sell them? I mean, is that you're doing art to sell them, or what is your end game?
Unless, as you noted on the website, if they're marked sold, it's because they have been sold. I don't sell, you know, tons of them, but I do sell them fairly regularly. The people who buy them seem to be absolutely thrilled to have a piece of fiber art that's, you know, really unique. A lot of them that I've sold at this point are some of the bigger ones, which pleases me to no end, but that people, you know, want to have a big piece of needle art on their wall. And it's one of the things that I felt is sort of my mission, to sort of educate people to look at needlepoint and see art where art is, you know, because mm-hmm. it's not
just a craft.
It's not just a craft, and I'm doing it the same way with the same level of vision and skill and commitment as any painter does their work. So I have to sort of keep putting this out there, keep putting it in front of jurors. Even in the fiber art world, this is a challenge, just to get them to look at this and look at it in the same, with the same consideration of as a weaver or an art quilter. They just have sometimes there's blinders up there that they just can't conceive of something that was, you know, used to be dining room chairs or pillows. There's nothing at all wrong with that. It's just if somebody is doing it as art and is creating really nice works, and there's a few of us out there that are really working hard at this, I think that, you know, it's an uphill battle, but it's one I'm going to just continue to pursue, because I put it out in front of curators all the time, jurors for shows. So it does eventually, there are people who see what I do and sort of get what it is and that it's significant, but it isn't as easy as I would have liked it to have been. But I guess I like a challenge. you know, getting into Fantastic Fibers, which is an international fiber show, and I have gotten in 3 times. And my happy point is that I got in with 3 totally different style works, which means I'm not being pigeonholed or told I'm exclusively this kind of an artist. So I'm happy about that. But it is, there will be a needlepoint artist in a show like that only every couple of years. And they should be represented in every show if there's quality work being made. They should be looked at with the same eyes as the other people who are submitting. But yeah, it is just one of those things.
Yeah, you guys have to be a pretty small club. The only other one I've seen do anything along your lines, I think I have the name right, is it Connie Stover in Michigan?
Yeah. Connie's very good. There's others. I can't remember her name. There's a woman in Canada, and there was a woman in Australia too. You're right, it's a pretty small club, but there's, you know, people who are having a lot of fun being creative. It's the more people see it, the more they will believe that they can do it. In terms of if they were unwilling to consider making something creative in needlepoint, if they see it's being done out in the world and that people are starting to look at it this way, whatever, I'm not going to call it stigma, but whatever hang up that they have or insecurity that they might have about doing it themselves, I'm just sort of hoping that eventually people will try just even a small thing and say, yeah, wow, that was really neat and it's all mine.
Yeah.
You have nothing to lose, a little bit of time, and that's not really lost time. You know, I don't see that as a loss at all.
No, I don't think so. I encourage people just to try stuff whenever they can, because there's a certain level of gratification you get from creating something and it's yours. It came from this place in you, and no matter how simple it is, it's still yours, and you can't take that away from the person.
Yeah. Christine and I have a mutual friend, Karen Talbot, also lives in Maine. She's a brilliant scientific illustrator, just brilliant, and makes prints of her paintings and colorings and whatever, uses colors, pencil, whatever, makes prints, but then she'll sell the originals. And I asked her one time, I said, it must really tear you up to see one of those originals go out the door. And I was really surprised. She said to me, nope, not at all. I'll just make another one. And that, it just really surprised me, because you pour your heart and soul into into the creating that, and then it goes to live somewhere else. Do you have feelings when one goes away?
No, I have to echo your friend. I make them because I think whatever I'm doing is, especially something that's going to take me months to make, I have to be drawn to the subject. I want to see it to fruition, but I'm making it for that purpose, that the hope is that somebody else will want it in their world. And when I sold my first big one, it's the triptych of the Aurora Borealis, and it also was my most expensive tapestry too. The piece took from it took from the moment I started it to completion 15 months. And it's like 60 inches across, and it's a big piece. It's a real wall of art. And when I sold it, an artist friend said, "How bad are you feeling right now?" And I said, "I'm feeling really good." I have a really nice check in my hand. I'm feeling really good because it's very affirming to have someone write to a check and say they want this. They see what you're doing. They appreciate it. They value it. And it's going to be part of their world. So I have no problem selling work. I sold a piece this spring, and I'd had it for a couple of years. It was one of my husband's favorites. And, you know, as I packaged it up to ship it, I said, "Say goodbye to the moon," because it's going to be hanging in Nashville now.
Talk about Winterthur. We hear about that all the time. What is that like for those of us who've never been there?
Oh, it's just absolutely stunning museum. The collections are so impressive, and a lot of fiber art there. I mean, obviously not necessarily contemporary fiber art, but just gorgeous handwork, centuries worth of handwork. And the grounds are pretty nice too. But it was a beautiful setting. I think they're going to be offering another one next year, a shading workshop. I think that's what they're going to be talking about doing, educating people on learning how to blend fibers and put colors next to each other that you wouldn't think of putting next to each other. So it should be a fun workshop, but it is a beautiful, beautiful setting. And if you ever get a chance to go, I highly recommend it.
Now, is it a museum inside? Is it a permanent collection, or is it?
Yes.
Okay.
It's floors upon floors of rooms all set up with the collection from Mr. DuPont, who just amassed, I think it's the largest collection of decorative arts in the United States.
Oh.
And so it's everything. It's porcelains, it's textiles, it's furniture, paintings, it's everything. Very impressive.
Wow, I did not realize it was that much.
Oh, yeah, no, it's, I mean, you could spend several days there. I mean, we got to take a few tours as part of the retreat, but the grounds are stunning. It's just overall, it's a lot to take in. Almost overload. There's so much to look at. But it is beautiful. It's beautifully run. They only take small groups into each room. It's very synchronized so that everything is very carefully protected. Mm-hmm. It's just really, really beautiful.
Oh, I smell a Fiber Talk road trip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Talk about your teaching. I'm intrigued. That was the first time I saw, and then I saw that you do classes. How do you go about that? Because, you know, the classes I've been exposed to is, here's a design I did, now I'm going to show you how to do it, and then you replicate it. And that's not what you do there. So how do you, what is a class like for you?
Well, a design class, what it will incorporate is some preliminary work before I actually even meet physically with the student. We will exchange a lot of correspondence on what they are thinking about putting on canvas. And everybody's visions are different, and some will need more support, shall we say, that they're less confident about their approach, and then other people have it all sort of figured out in their head, and they just shock me that they've, you know, really given this a lot of thought, or this is the way their mind works, or they do other creative things too, and this just is an extension, so it's not as difficult for them. But we'll spend several weeks back and forth sort of creating a design, deciding on a size, deciding on a canvas count, putting things in proportion, telling, you know, them, okay, so this is we'll say a piece with butterflies. How do you want the butterflies to be? The person didn't know exactly how they wanted the butterflies to be. But what? You were asking about the design. And so I do find that some people will need extra coaxing, but they all eventually are capable of coming up with a concept that they want to work with. And it's really neat to see things start to click for them.
When you do one of these, then you're really just doing that delicate dance of guiding without limiting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Encouraging, showing them where they could do things, encouraging different stitches where it might be more valuable, things like that.
Jill, this has just been an absolute treat here. Really appreciate the time and fascinating stitching and art. I shouldn't even call it stitching. I should just say fascinating art that you create. And I got to believe sitting there and watching you in one of your 8-hour sessions just stitch away would be a lot of fun to do. Yeah. Yep.
Well, it sort of looks like a mad woman, so I don't know.
Oh no, I think I could sit there quite easily. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Well, I've said to my husband if I predecease him, I said on my headstone, please just put just one more thread. It's my nighttime thing, as he says, you gotta quit. And I'll just say one more thread, just one more thread.
Yep. All right, Jill, sure appreciate it. Thanks for doing this with us.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a pleasure.
All right, thanks for listening, and Christine and I will be back on Wednesday.